Oh boy, is this going to be so much fun. Why? Because we are ready to look at the entire semester in a single presentation. This is it, dear students. This is the entire semester in one presentation. Well, not really, obviously, right? But this idea of risk versus return, will be with us for the rest of the semester and must always be foremost in your mind whenever you take a look at any type of investment. Okay? All right. So let's get started. On slide number 35, investment return revisited. Now, did you go back over and take a look at the overview of investments and make sure you understand everything that is in those slides, because that's all you need to know for now about stocks, bonds, mutual funds, short-term investments, and the like? Yeah. Over the long term, equities, stocks, that's the fancy word for stocks, corporations, companies, businesses, have produced the best returns for investors. Stocks have returned 8 to 12%. Some have done better, some have done worse. I usually tell people 8 to 10%. So I don't want to get them too excited, because anything above 10% is pretty darn good, folks. But as we'll see, that's been the norm over the last century. Fixed income securities, bonds, loans, when you lend your money, have returned around 4 to 8, treasuries and munis 4 to 6, corporate bonds 6 to 8, but right now, no, they're returning far less than that. And short-term investments, cash instruments, savings accounts, CDs and the like, they've returned 2 to 5%, sometimes more, sometimes less, in fact now, a whole lot less. And mutual funds will more or less, often less, reflect the underlying assets that they invest in. If they invest in stocks, yes. If they invest in bonds, right, you get the return that these underlying investments will return. Normally, assuming your mutual fund managers do a decent job, that is. Slide number 36. Let's take a look at a dollar and how it's done between 1925 and 1926 up to 2012. And I want you to ignore small company stocks. Just ignore them, folks. The reason is because even the people who make these statistics will tell you that there is a bias here. It's called survivorship bias. Many small companies simply don't last very long. And so the ones that have turned into nothing are gone. Right. But if we take a look at large company stocks, a dollar has done pretty darn well for us, folks. It's turned into $3,000 through the Great Depression, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, inflation of the oil shocked 1970s, 80s, and 90s. The 2000s, wow! And I want you to take a quick look at this this scale here. That doesn't look right. Wait a minute. It goes from 1 to 10 to 100 to 1,000, 1,000, 10,000. What's going on? That's called a logarithmic scale. And what it is doing is turning an exponential curve into a straight curve. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, don't worry about it. All you need to know is that these get big. These numbers get big. In fact, look at the small company stocks. I know I told you to ignore it, but let's take a quick look. That's ridiculous, right? I mean, there are, obviously, every large company was once a small company, but still, as we said, there's a lot of small companies that have you'll never even hear of because they disappeared many decades ago or even that last year, and you never even heard of them. So ignore that number. But look at the difference between what stocks, large company stocks, have done versus bonds. You know, bonds have done okay. You know, a dollar has turned into $112, but still, look at the difference. And that's because of that extra 2, 3, 4% a year. That exponential growth. Mm-hmm. That's called opportunity cost for you economics fans, right? By placing our money into long-term government bonds, much safer, much less volatile, much more secure, better chance of getting what we expect to get, we gave up all that extra return. But look at what short-term investments have returned us, as measured by Treasury bills, which we'll discuss in the next presentation. But they're a type of short-term investment. 3, 4, 5% has returned $22. It's done better than inflation, but not a whole lot. Yeah, we want to beat inflation, and it shows, this graph shows that if we are willing to put up with the volatility, the risk associated with owning stocks, we can be rewarded handsomely over the long term. But here on slide 37 is a graph that is gone. What happened to the graph? I have to go back and find the graph. Hang on a minute, folks. There it is. I don't know what happened, folks. Microsoft. Putrid point. There it is, and I don't know why it disappeared, but I'll fix it. It just reappeared when I paused it and then paged up and paged down. It came back. I don't know what's going on. But here is a much longer term perspective. Look, 200 years of investments, starting with a dollar. And again, look at the, now this isn't the short, the small company stocks. These are the large company stocks. And they have returned, I mean, he's got 12 years of investment horizon. But still, look at the difference. And again, there's our logarithmic scale. But this one, the one the reason I want to show you this one is to show you gold. There are some of you who are thinking, well, when's he going to talk about gold? Let's talk about gold. Yeah, at the end of the semester, folks, at the end of the semester, we'll show you why gold is a terrible investment for the long term. Go ahead, throw arrows at me, I don't care, but when does gold do well? Gold does well when people believe the world is going to end, like in the 1860s, right, Great Depression. Right, I'm not sorry, Great Depression, the Civil War, right? The Civil War, and then the Great Depression again, and then the 70s when there were oil shocks and inflation. But then, look at gold. For 20 years, it's done well the last, 10, 12 years, but lately it's been showing it's not that great. The problem with gold is you have to know when to buy, and you have to know when to sell. You have to be a speculator. We're getting ahead of ourselves. Because we're going to discuss the difference between an investor and a speculator. But look at what stocks have done for us, folks. Are you excited? I hope you are. If you have a long-term perspective, and if you make it through the rest of the semester to learn about the different types of stocks, because not all stocks are created equal, and some are a whole lot riskier than others. Indeed. Let's continue. Slide number 38. Because we cannot discuss return without discussing risk. Yeah, I know. You want to talk about how good it's going to get, but we also have to talk about times which are not so good. And so let's take a look at slide 38. Investment risk. Dear students, it is no accident that stocks and bonds have produced better returns than short-term investments, than short-term cash, guaranteed investments, savings accounts, CDs, treasury bills. Otherwise, why would investors assume the higher risks associated with stocks and bonds? And the answer is they wouldn't. They wouldn't. If they could get the same kind of return from a treasury bill, you wouldn't deal with stocks or bonds. They would assume what is called the risk-free rate of return. That's the return on guaranteed short-term investments. And what they normally use for the risk-free rate of return is the return on U.S. treasury bills, specifically 3-month bills. Now, we're going to discuss these in more detail in the next presentation. and you, part of your assignment is to go out and find the returns on these things, and it's pretty darn low, folks, at treasurydirect.gov, along with a few other things to take a look at treasurydirect.gov. But if you really cannot deal with any type of risk, you're going to put your money here. But as we saw, you're not going to get rewarded for that. You're going to beat inflation over the long term, but not by much. And we call that reward for bearing risk the risk premium. It's the extra return on a risky asset over and above the risk-free rate of return. Hey, I'm dealing with stocks and the fact that they go up and down like crazy, like a roller coaster. Why? What am I getting out of it? What's in it for me? Well, that's called the risk premium. And on slide, again, it disappeared. What's going on here? Wait a minute. It came back. I don't know what's going on. The graphs are disappearing, and then when I page up and page down, they come back. Here they are, folks, on slide 39, the risk premiums. And again, let's ignore small company stocks because 17.5%, folks, no. Some of the best small company stock mutual funds have done 13%, 14%, 17.5%. That's not right. But sure enough, we tell people that we've gotten 8, 9, 10% from stocks, but large company stocks, now how do we measure large company stocks? We'll talk about this more when we get to chapter 4 and chapter 5, definitely in chapter 5. 11.7%. That's pretty darn good, folks. 11.7%. And treasury bills have returned 3.7%, so the risk premium is 8%. If we're willing to accept the risk of stocks, we expect to get a pretty darn good risk premium. Now, I don't tell people, as I said, 11.5%, 11.7%. I tell people 8, 9, 10%. And dear folks, I am happy if I get 8, 9, 10%. I don't know about you. That's pretty darn good. But long-term corporate bonds have returned 6.6%. And long-term government bonds have returned over the long-term 6.2%. Now, they're not returning that now. No way. But over the long term, that's what they've given us. So they've given us a risk premium of 2.9 and 2.5%, which, you know, for some people, that's enough. They're happy with that. I ain't. I am not happy with that, especially if I have a long-term perspective. And I hope that you will learn that, yeah, I can deal with the volatility. I can live with the ups and downs because I want to get, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7% risk premium. I want to beat inflation by a goodly amount. But that's up to you. And, of course, there's a mix. Some people have some bonds and some stocks. Now, look at treasury bills. What's the risk premium? Nothing, right? Because there's no default risk on treasury bills. The United States government will pay its debts. I don't care what anybody says, dear students. The United States government will pay its debts. But there's a risk here. As we'll see when we get to the next presentation in short-term investments, the risk is that your investments will lose to inflation. You will lose purchasing power. Yeah. So what I hope you will figure out by the end of the semester, and if not right now, is that no investment is risk-free. We're talking about risk of loss here. No, treasury bills will not lose money unless the United States government disappears, which isn't going to happen. But you can lose to inflation. Your amount will not keep pace, or maybe not keep pace very well to inflation. As we saw, treasury bills beat inflation, but not by much, because during this period, inflation ran at 3.1%. Yeah, not so great. Whereas if you've been in it for the long term and held on to stocks, you've done pretty darn good, folks. And again, ignore small company stocks. Let's see if the graph shows up here. Oh, no, not a graph here. Slide number 40. Risk versus reward. Risk versus return. Do you want to eat well or do you want to sleep well? Investment return is very straightforward. How much did you start with? How much did you end with? What was your time frame? That's your return. But measuring how much risk you took to receive that return is much more difficult. In fact, there really is no good one good way to measure risk. You can't really measure it well because risk is something that you can't really anticipate until it happens, and then it's kind of too late. And so we come up with the best measurement we could, and that's called standard deviation. Each year, the investment community measures the average annual return and the amount of variance from the average annual return. So what do we get over the long term? 8, 9, 10%. But every year, how much does it vary up and down? And we use statistics. And we create these measures called variance and standard deviation. And here they are. No, don't run for the exits, folks. We're not going to do the calculations. Why? Because we just look them up. Somebody else has done them for us. We will leave the calculations for your statistics class. Suffice to say, very important, the higher the variance, the higher the standard deviation, the riskier the investment. The higher the variance in standard deviation, the more the investment return will deviate from the average annual return. And what is this math mumbo jumbo? Well, let's go through it. It really isn't that hard once you get past all the stupid little symbols here. But here's what we're doing here is we're taking for every year that we're measuring our return, we're taking the return in that year and we're subtracting it from the average return. And then we square it. And why do we do that? Well, sometimes it's above and sometimes it's below. And if we square the difference, we get rid of all the negative signs. That's all we do. That's the reason they square it. And then this symbol right here means summation. It's sigma. And it means to sum all those differences. So we take the difference between the actual return every year and the average return over those years. And then we square it and then add them all up and divide by the number of years minus. Why do we do that? Let's take statistics. It's called the central limit theory. But anyway, you get a number called the variance. And then you take the square root because we squared it over here and now we're going to take the square root. And that's called the standard deviation. And that tells you how much on average, you're going to deviate. You're going to vary from your average annual returns. And realistically, folks, these are just fancy schmancy ways of saying you can lose your money, right? That's all they're really saying is how far will you vary from what you expect to get. And so looking at slide 42, I hope you're still with me. If not, back up a little bit because it's not really that difficult once you see it. If we look at slide 42, what we see here are the years from 1926 to 2014. And in every year, we've put the year in the category where the large company stocks have returned. So, for example, between 0 and 10%, 1947, 1948, 1956, 1960. You see those? Between 10 and 20%, 1926, 1944, 1949. Exactly. And then minus, right, between 0 and negative 10%, 1929, 1932. Uh-huh. Exactly. So what you see is that for the most part, most of the years are positive. More years are above zero than below zero. But sometimes, yeah, look at 2000, 2001, 2002. Right, what happened is we had many years where the stock market went in two directions, up and way up, 1980 to 1999. And look at this. Here, where is it? Where can we find it? People were so excited. They were so frightened, too, because where's 1990? Where's 1995? Where is 90? There it is. 95 was over 30%, and people thought, oh, the market's got to fall. And 1996 was 20%. And then 1997 was over 30%. And then 1998 was over 20%. And 1999 was over 20%. And people got it in their heads that the market would never go down. And then bingo, 1-0, 2000, 2001, 2002 went down 3 years in a row. And 2002 was rough, folks. But then look at 2008. Oh, boy, that was tough. But the worst year, 1931, the depths of the Great Depression. And 2013 was actually a pretty darn good year, up over 20-some percent. And then everybody thought, oh, God, it's going to go down, right? It's got to go down. And then 2014, it went up 11.4%, I think. Right, exactly. So do you know in any one year where the market's going to go? No. And if anybody tells you they do, just smile and shake their hand and realize that they're fooling themselves. Because there have been tremendous resources put into trying to predict what's going to happen the next year, and they've all messed up. Nobody's been able to do it. And to be a good investor, you don't have to. In fact, you shouldn't. You shouldn't worry about what's going to happen next year. You should think about what's going to happen in 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Yeah, at least that's my humble opinion. And I'm sticking with it. So far, it's worked for me. But does this distribution of annual returns on common stocks, specifically large company stocks, does it remind you of anything that you may be familiar with? I hope so. Right. It's called the normal distribution. The bell curve, sometimes it's called. And for some odd reason, nature has been very kind to us. And when you take a sample of populations of whatever, people's heights, or how long car batteries will last, or many different things, you'll find that they fall along the lines of what is called the normal distribution. And the same thing is true for the average annual return of investments. They follow a bell curve, a normal distribution. And what's it saying here? Well, look, 11.7% is our average annual return. That's the middle of the bell curve. But in any given year, there's about a two-thirds chance, 68% to be precise, that the actual return will fall 1 minus or 1 plus the standard deviation. And the standard deviation is almost 20%. So it's a little over 20%. So you see, it goes from 11.7 up to 32.2. But at the same time, it could go down to minus 8.8. And that's a two-thirds chance it's going to fall in there. There's a 95% chance that it'll fall within 2 standard deviations. Meaning, 5%, exactly, 95% of the chance of the time, 95% of the time, it's going to fall within plus 52% down to minus 29%. And then, 5 out of 100 years, 5 times out of 100, it's going to fall 3 standard deviations. You see? But do you know what it's going to be in any given year? No. Plus 12, minus 14, plus 22. That's what investing in stocks is like, folks. It's a roller coaster. And investment returns over time tend to mirror the normal distribution. So you have to be prepared for this. Not only intellectually, but emotionally, because it ain't fun to lose 20% of your money. But it's going to happen. It's going to happen. Well, at least history tells us it's going to happen. And I think they're right. We just don't know when. people will ask me, well, is there going to be a crash? I say, yeah, there's going to be a crash. When? I don't know when. I know it's going to happen. It's the history of capitalism. When something better comes along, I'm sure I'll be there jumping up and down, screaming and hollering. But until then, slide 44. And these are from your book, the sixth edition. And they're really not the best graphs. What they're trying to show you as is the greater the standard deviation, the greater the average annual return, and the lower the standard deviation, the lower the average annual return. And so what you should be keying on is the width, the spread, so to speak. The wider the standard deviation, the more chances are that your investment's going to bounce up and down, and there's going to be years that you're going to lose money. And notice that as the standard deviation gets smaller and smaller, the width gets smaller and smaller. Now, the problem with this is the frequencies should be a lot higher. For treasury bills and inflation, these bars are the same height as the bars up here in large company and small company stocks, and that's just not the case. These distribution numbers, they don't show the scale, but these numbers are actually a lot smaller, and so I might be confusing you, but what I want you to key on is the width, the spread, how far apart these are. And notice that the government bonds have had a standard deviation that's actually higher than the long-term corporate bonds. Very strange indeed, very strange. Normally, as the standard deviation gets larger, the average return gets larger. So there might be something wrong with this. I got this from the book, so there might be something wrong with the book. But you see, in general, the higher the standard deviation, the higher the average annual return. The lower the standard deviation, the lower the average annual return. We are being paid to take on risk. Slide 45. Now, this is another graph from your book, and if it doesn't make any sense, ignore it, but it's trying to show you yet again the relationship. As the standard deviation on the bottom of the graph goes higher, the average annual return to the left, on the y-axis, goes higher. So T-bills, low standard deviation, low return. Treasury bonds, higher standard deviation, higher return. Large company stocks, higher standard deviation, higher return. And then again, small company stocks, the data is just not very good, so we'll ignore it for now. So if this graph helps, great. If it doesn't help, just ignore it. Don't get all bent out of shape by it. Okay, let's go to our next slide. And so, Do you remember we talked about the countries and the return, and we said Sweden and the Netherlands and Denmark have had better returns than the US of A? What's going on here? Well, now we can complete the global picture regarding risk versus return. Sure, Sweden had a better return than the United States, but look at the standard deviation. You had to accept about 60% more risk to get that return. So who had the best risk-adjusted return? You better believe it, boobies. Right. Okay, all right, piano. But you see, look at the United States. There's a reason why we are so well liked by investors all around the world, because they're not stupid. They see that our returns are good, yeah, but our standard deviation, the volatility, is far less than other countries of the world. Make sense? Yeah, okay, good. So they have big deals, so they have socialized medicine, right? Slide number 47. So, dear students, does yous got it yet? Yous wants high returns? Yous gonna get high risk. Yous gonna lose some money. And if you're very, very aggressive, you might lose all your money. And if anybody tells you differently, Dandelion. It's that simple. So I revert back to my Philadelphia ancestry. It's going to happen, folks. And what we're going to show you is that, great, it's not the end of the world. And if it is the end of the world, doesn't matter where you put your money. It's actually a good opportunity for you, especially if you're younger. But it's also a serious phenomenon that we have to acclimate ourselves to. We have to be ready, not only intellectually, but also emotionally when we get kicked in the gut by the market, because it's going to happen. And also we are arming ourselves, because there are going to be people out there who are going to try to feed on your greed. They're going to try to play on your greed. And at the same time, they're going to assure you that there's no risk. So when, not if, when you see an advertisement for a 12% safe rate of return, you will know that the chances of losing your money are pretty high. And when you see claims such as 300% or 3,000%, and you will, if you're involved in investing in any length of time, you're going to get on these mailing lists or email lists, and there are people who are out there who are, they're breaking the law, folks. This is illegal, but they do it. They will guarantee that you're going to get 3,000% by just taking our surefire two-day trading seminar, which will guarantee you riches beyond your belief. And when that doesn't work, we'll sell you the 9,995 exclusive five-day super secret trading classes that will, don't worry about burning your credit cards, because you're going to pay off that credit card and all the other credit cards. And then when that doesn't work, we'll send you to Hawaii for $25,000 if you mortgage your home. And then for 2 weeks, you will sit with the best traders in the world, and you will be assured of winding up in bankruptcy. You think I can make a lot of money if I didn't have any ethics? Yeah. Sit on your hands, grab your wallet, stay away from these people. They've been around. Wade Cook, for almost two decades, finally the SEC caught up with him, and they put him out of business, but then they just started up something else. Optionetics, they've stuck around. Excuse me. Sorry. They've toned down the rhetoric. At least I haven't seen them talking about 3,000% lately, but still, they're still trying to get people to sign up. And what happens with these companies is that they get a letter from the Securities and Exchange Commission saying, stop that. Don't do that. You know you can't do that. And they just ignore it. And then eventually the Securities and Exchange Commission sends them another letter saying, we told you to stop that. It's called a cease and desist order. And eventually they stop it and they start up some other company and to try to get people to part with their hard-earned money, thinking that they're going to be the next hotshot trader who's going to make a gazillion dollars in 9 months. And yikes. Slide 48. But isn't somebody doing it? I mean, aren't there people out there who are making money, tremendous rates of return, short-term? Yes, folks, there are, but those people are not investors. They are what we call traders, not traitors with a T, but traders with a D. A better word is speculators, right? Speculators. And speculation is the investment euphemism, the financial world's euphemism for gambling. Oh, we're not gambling, no, we're speculating. It's the same thing, in my humble opinion. And here is one of the most famous speculators. I mean, he knew what he was doing. He knew that he was trying to do things that most people couldn't do. And he was very upfront about it. And here's what he says about a speculator versus an investor. The speculator is not an investor. His object is not to secure a steady return on his money at a good rate of interest. Again, I would use the word return. But to profit by either a rise or a fall in the price of whatever he may be speculating in. And this is Jesse Livermore, a very well-known speculator who was moderately successful at his trade. But he warned people this is not for everybody. most people are better served by being an investor, by prudently investing for the long term, patient, and eating well and sleeping well, dealing with the every once in a while the falls in the market. Being a trader can be very, very profitable, folks, but it is also incredibly stressful and incredibly perilous. And you're up against the best in the world. And you don't even get to see them because everybody's sitting in front of a computer now. You don't even get to know who you're up against. I'm not a big sports fan, but I like the sports analogies. The last time I was in a batting cage, I went to one of these places that you could go 70 miles an hour. And I set it for 60, and I said, that's it, no thanks, that's too darn fast for me, excuse my French. It was really scary. And then you stop and think, in the major leagues, they're throwing that fastball at 95, 98, 100 miles an hour. Yeah, can you hit a fastball at 100 miles an hour? Right. And so there are only a few people in the world who can, and those people can make a lot of money. And the same thing is true for successful speculators. There are not too many people who can do it. And the people who can make a lot of money. But do you want to go up against them? So I ask you, do you want to be an investor or do you want to be a speculator? Because we can help you learn how to become a patient, prudent, successful long-term investor. We can help you identify attractive long-term investments that should do well. There are no guarantees. And we can help you identify speculative issues that could make you very wealthy very quickly or turn into dust. Yes, we can do that. In fact, that's what this class is all about. You will learn to identify stocks and bonds that have varying degrees of return versus their risk. We cannot help you learn how to become a successful short-term speculator. Sorry, I can't do it. I'm not even going to try. Whenever I have tried to shoot for the fences or whatever it's called, to throw the Hail Mary pass, whatever analogy you want to use to, I have failed miserably. And I knew going in that this was a very speculative issue, and I was rolling the dice or trying to hit the 95 mile an hour fastball. And I struck out, and I rolled craps. I mean, I didn't put a lot of money on the table, as they said. I didn't bet a lot of money, but I bet. I speculated in small company, biotech companies. Basically, most of them were based here in San Diego. And I went to the meetings and I listened to the technology, and it was always really exciting and everything, but for one reason or another, exactly. And so in the face-to-face class now, what we would do is we would read the story of John Goodfriend versus John Merriweather. And it's a very famous story in the investment community, and there's a recording of me reading it from a book called Wall Street People, which took it from a book called, I forget the name of the, Liar's Poker. So I want you to, maybe not right now, but I want you to listen to that, because these are the kind of people you're up against. And you just stop and you take a breath and you think, okay, I think I'm going to get out of this batting cage right now and save my skin. Also here, I used to have a link to a Forbes article. It was a video where Steve Forbes interviewed John Bogle, and the guy who started Vanguard. And, oh, he just said it so distinctly. He asked people, he said, look, first you have to decide, do you want to be an investor or do you want to be a speculator? You have to decide that, because until you understand which you're going to be, you are just going to be fleeced. You're just going to be skinned alive if you don't understand that. But they took it down, so I apologize. I should have copied it, but you're not supposed to do that, so I just had a link to it. That's perfectly all right. but I should have copied it because now it's gone forever. Slide 49. Okay, all right, Piano, stop. Stop preaching at me. I got it. I understand. So what's a realistic rate of return for me? All right. Well, after you have taken this course, you will have a strong knowledge of the most popular types of financial investments, the most popular types of securities, stocks, bonds, cash, mutual funds. You will also know what levels of returns and what levels of risk you should reasonably expect to receive from each. And if you are a patient, long-term investor, I believe it is realistic to expect 8 to 10% over the long term, unless the world falls apart, and then which it doesn't matter where your money is. I'm certainly working on it myself, and so far so good, right? It's been, even with 2008, folks, it's been pretty darn good to us. Of course, as meaning my wife and I, because we're a team here, as we will reiterate time and time again, there are no guarantees. The world could end. There could be no food at the grocery store, at the Vons, no gas at the Chevron station, no clothes at the Gap, the cell phones aren't working, the utility, SDG&E, is not pumping out gas, is not pumping out electricity anymore. The fire departments and the police departments and the hospitals and the schools and the banks are all shuttered and the trash isn't being picked up and the sewage is all, the whole thing could crack, fall apart, and turn into nothing. In which case, it doesn't matter what stocks or mutual funds or bonds you own. You'll be worried about where to get the next meal. I hear that moth soup is actually pretty good. Yeah, if you really believe that's going to happen, get out of the Northern Hemisphere. Go down to Tierra del Fuego and learn to raise goats. And there are some people who believe the whole thing is going to fall apart. And they barricade themselves in and buy lots of ammunition and food. And they don't have any idea what's happening with a million people running around trying to scrounge for food. They got 4,000 rounds of ammunition. Good luck with that. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, Piano. So enough of this. What can 8 to 10% do for me? Slide 50. Is it good enough? Is 9 or 10% good enough? Well, it turns out the answer to this question is yes. But there are some caveats. There are some big ifs. If you start early, if you are patient and consistent, if you do not get too cocky, too greedy, and you do not chase after every next big thing that comes along, and most importantly, you do not panic when the market swoons, because it's going to happen. History tells us it's going to happen. Capitalism is this long history of booms and busts and booms and busts. The trick is to take advantage of the time value of money, compound annual return. And this is actually from the Business 121 class. We discussed this in more detail. Because we're going to do the other side of the coin when we get to chapter 6. The time value of money is the amount to which a sum you invest now will increase based on a specified rate of return and time period. We call this compounding. You are going from now into the future. And we can do this for a single amount, a lump sum, a principal, a lump sum principal, single payment, or we can do it for a series of deposits, a stream of investments. It's also called an annuity, but I don't like to use that term because that's also a life insurance product, which happens to be not a very good product. We will learn how to move from the future back to the present. That's called discounting, present value of money. That's really cool, and we're going to learn that in Chapter 6. When we learn how to assign valuations to stocks, and then again in Chapter 10, and to assign valuations to bonds. And so in the face-to-face class, what we would do is just look at the exercises. We don't have time for them in the face-to-face class. I'm not going to ask you these on the exam, so don't worry about them. But there is a worksheet, and then there's an answer key and a commentary. And it can show you that if you just start early, folks, that's why we love it when the millennials take this class and they're, you know, in their early 20s or even before then, or even into your 30s, you still have plenty of time. It's the baby boomers in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, and the late Gen Xers that come up to me and go, I didn't tell me this 25 years ago. Sorry. So don't worry. If you want to do it, go ahead and do it. If you don't want to do it, don't worry about it. If you're in the 121 class, you better do them because they're the same, similar as the 121 class, and you need to do them for 121. So, but we're not, again, I reiterate, you do not have to learn how to do these because I will not ask them on the exam. Slide 53. One last comment on risk versus return. Psst, here is one of Boiano's secret tips. Avoid large losses. Okay, where would you put $100? So you take a look at these two investments, investment A and investment B. And investment A does 85% in 1 year. Whoopee! Investment B does 10%. And then investment A loses 50%. Well, you knew it was very speculative when you got into it. But investment B gets 9%. Which one would you choose? Well, many people will choose investment A because they figure 85%, I'm still up 30%, right? The numbers don't work the same going up as they do going down. In the first year, your $100 became $185 for investment A, $110 for investment B. In year number two, you see what 50% can do to you? And history tells us that if you're invested in high growth, high risk stocks, it's going to happen at least once in your investing career. But the slow and steady tortoise exactly wins the race. Now, before we embark on the process of identifying and familiarizing ourselves with the longer term, higher yielding instruments, such as stocks, bonds, mutual funds, let us learn how and where to park our money using short-term investments. So our last presentation for Chapter 1 will be a discussion of those short-term investments. And that's part of your assignment. Your assignment, that is your assignment, you're going to go to treasurydirect.gov and research these things and find out what they're currently paying. And then go to a mutual fund company and find some money markets. And go to a bank, a credit union, and find CDs and savings accounts and the like. But one last time, one more time, wait a second. The greater the variance and standard deviation of the average annual returns of investment, A, the greater the risk, the more volatile it is. B, the lesser the risk, the less volatile it is. There is no correlation. There is, in other words, there's no relationship between standard deviation and average annual returns. And standard what? I always hated statistics. You know the answer to this, right? Don't you dare get this one wrong on the exam, because it's bad for my self-esteem, folks. That's when I know people, they don't even listen or watch or read the presentations when they get this one wrong. So please don't get it wrong. Yeah, it makes me feel sad. Because you're going to be the expert. You're going to be the expert for your friends or family and your coworkers, and you can't let them down. You have to help them because they're just as lost as you are now. But you know, you're a little bit, you can see some more of the forest and the trees, and but they're completely lost, and they go, well, I don't understand. I put it in. The guy told me it was a very safe, high return investment, and I've lost half of my money. Yeah, you got to help them. Okay, so now, what are you going to do? Go back over and make sure you understand this wonderful relationship, this eternal tug of war. Do you want to eat well, or do you want to sleep well? Risk versus return. Risk versus return. And in our next presentation, as we said, we will concentrate on short-term investments. Get them out of the way. And a place to park our money. Thank you, thank you, thank you for sticking with us. We've got a long road to hoe, but we're on the right track. And if you get what's in Chapter 1, it all follows from here. See you in our next and last presentation for Chapter 1.